Welcome. This is Dr. Philip E. Stieg, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, the New York Presbyterian Hospital, and I'd like to welcome you to How to Save Your Life. This week, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Mark Lax, the Irene F. and I. Roy Patsy Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Today, we are going to talk about a topic of great interest, the aging process. Sometimes those aches and pains aren't due to age. For the answer to concerns about growing old, stay tuned. We will be right back. Hello, and welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and today I'm talking with Dr. Mark Lax, the Irene F. and I. Roy Patsy Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Mark, what does a geriatrician do?
Well, Phil, a geriatrician is usually an internist, sometimes a family practitioner, who has taken additional training after a residency in internal medicine or family practice, who usually provides primary care for older people. And I think the most significant difference from how I function in comparison to a doctor who cares for younger people is the emphasis really on patients' ability to function as opposed to individual diagnoses. Because by the time someone meets me, they often have several diagnoses at the same time. Some of them might be serious, some of them not so. So I'm really interested in people's ability to carry on their daily activities and remain independent.
So I guess I'm kind of asking you how old you have to be one of your patients, but more broadly, I mean, who really qualifies to see a person who specializes in geriatrics?
Probably the most common question that geriatricians are asked. How old is geriatric? And again, I come back to this idea of function. It's not really about a number per se, but it's about your ability to carry on activities in your environment. So, for example, Phil, there are 85-year-olds in my practice who jump on and off the examining table nearly as spryly as people in their 20s or 30s, and those are geriatric patients. And then, sadly, in the nursing home that I practice at, sometimes I'll meet patients in their 40s or 50s who've gotten neurological diseases like multiple sclerosis. Now, those are chronologically young patients, but functionally, they may be bedbound or have impairments in mobility and function that make them like geriatric patients. So it's really not about age. It's about functional ability. And in general, I care for patients who are very high functioning who are older, but also patients who might be in the early throes of some functional problems or some decline. But that's generally what differentiates geriatric medicine from the care of younger people.
So if I'm the public out there listening to you right now, how do I know? I mean, how would I decide? Should I start looking for a person who's specializing in geriatrics versus just going and finding an internist? I mean, what do I decide? How do I decide that?
Well, the first problem, Phil, is that the public will have trouble finding a geriatrician. There's a critical shortage of geriatricians in the United States.
How many are there, do you know?
Well, right now, I think there are about somewhere between 7,000 and 9,000, depending on who you read, even fewer geriatric psychiatrists, another subspecialty of psychiatry that maybe we can talk about a little bit later. But in the past, most physicians in training have wanted to be like Phil Stieg, a neurosurgeon or a cardiologist. Geriatric medicine until recently has not been a highly sought after field. I tell patients that if they have a good relationship with an internist who has been providing care for a long period of time for them, who they seem to be having a good doctor-patient relationship with, their function is good, their health is good, that they should continue to maintain a relationship with that physician. That's why our role in educating physicians in the community and in training about geriatrics is so crucial, because there'll just never be enough of us to provide primary care for all the older people in an exploding America that is aging with older people.
Do you find that patients find you or doctors send you patients because they're a little bit overwhelmed with the complexity of the problem that this elderly patient has?
Sometimes patients come on their own. Very frequently, I'm sought after in consultation, the way a cardiologist might be for a chest pain or for a rhythm problem. An internist might call me and say, "Can you tell me if this person is suffering from Alzheimer's disease or depression, for example? This person seems to be on too many medications. Can you help me whittle them down?" I would add to that category, often it is the adult children of patients who refer them to me. And on more than one occasion, a patient has come to my office, perhaps thinking that they were going out to lunch or something, and they wound up in my practice for an evaluation. And those can be stressful interactions, but sometimes it happens, and it usually works out for the better.
So do you ever find yourself sitting, like you said, you're out to lunch with somebody. Do you ever find yourself sitting across the table looking at someone going, that person needs me? And what do you see?
Well, again, the interesting thing about what I do is that it's not a discrete disease or diagnosis that gets people to me. Again, the reason that there are so many older people in America now is the tremendous advances in other areas of medicine. You know, a patient who would have been felled by cardiovascular disease in the 1950s or 1960s now has a piece of rigatoni put in one of their arteries. A patient who would have had colon cancer 20 or 30 years ago now has a colonoscopy. And so people come to me with different kinds of problems, problems in mobility, memory, mood, vision, not dramatic in and of themselves alone, but they gradually chip away at their independence and dare I say, dignity. And they seek me for an overarching view of their healthcare and try to figure out which of those problems might be addressable and which might not be. But it's for a comprehensive evaluation.
So in essence, the fact that you and your subspecialty exist is really a sign of hope for all people out there. I mean, we are medicine, despite the bad name that it appears to have, is actually doing an effective job. It's saving people, keeping them alive longer, so now they're developing new problems or different kinds of problems that you have to cope with.
I think, Phil, you hit it on the nose. I mean, if you ask yourself the question, how are we to know if all the money that's been poured into biotechnology, say, since World War II, into the pharmaceutical industry, into these magnificent academic medical centers like our own, how would you know if that effort's been successful? And I would argue you'll know that if you're left with a population of older people struggling with the kinds of problems that I see in my daily practice.
We're baby boomers. I see my parents getting older. I feel myself getting older. Is there a method to look for potential functional disabilities somewhere down the road?
Well, you know, we're learning more and more about that each day. And the problem has been that the traditional internal medicine exam that you get from your family doctor, your internist, isn't really geared towards picking up functional problems. I'll give you a few examples. You would feel absolutely ripped off if you went to the doctor and he didn't bang on that little tendon over your knee to see if your leg jerked forward. And that's very interesting, and I do that to patients when I examine them. But I'm much more interested in seeing a patient get up from the examining table, walk 10 feet, turn around, and sit down. That's a much more functionally oriented test of gait, of walking. Another example is hearing. Again, you'd probably feel slighted if your internist didn't take that that otoscope out, that instrument we use to look at in ears, and look, and he might say, wow, this is fascinating. It looks like when you were 6 or 7, you had otitis, an ear infection, and there's scarring there. And I do that, but I'll also whisper several numbers into a patient's ear to see if they can hear the spoken word, because that's a much more relevant functional test of daily activity. In the same way, I'll make patients read their prescription bottle. Yeah, I also blind them with that ophthalmoscope that we use to look in their eyes and that you use all the time as a neurosurgeon. But I want to see if they can go home and read the prescription bottle that came from my prescription. Otherwise, they're going to get into deep difficulty. So I'm trying to paint a picture that I'm really interested in people's ability to get around in their environment in a real way. And again, traditional medical practice has not been geared in that way. And it's primarily because traditional medical practice had mostly young people in it for many, many decades. An 80-year-old in a medical practice at the turn of the century, the last turn of the century, was probably a rarity. And now it's more the rule in internal medicine practice.
So do you see a change in the curriculum in medical schools now, getting students to focus on those functional types of exams so that those that go into family practice are better at this?
The answer is yes. There's been a big push, much of it led by a foundation that's funded a number of medical schools. In the United States, the Donald W. Reynolds Foundation has given large grants to medical schools, including one to our own, to improve geriatrics in the curriculum. With that grant, for example, every one of our medical students before graduating makes a house call in our house call program. Another thing that differentiates geriatricians, I think, from other kinds of doctors, we frequently see patients at home because their mobility and other limitations, or inclement weather, precludes them from getting out in their environment.
Do you have to communicate differently with an elderly patient versus a 30-year-old?
Well, again, this goes to the issue that there are certain conditions and diseases that are more common as people get older, but aging itself is not a disease. So, for example, hearing loss, common as we age, usually high-frequency hearing loss is the most common. Incidentally, I often see people screaming at the top of their lungs to older people to try and communicate. That's the worst thing you can do because that's the upper frequency ranges. You know, I tell students that they should get within direct view of the older person, use other visual cues like the mouth moving to communicate. Certainly older patients can develop some intellectual or cognitive impairment if they develop diseases like early Alzheimer's. But again, that's not all patients. And to assume that all patients are impaired, hard of hearing, have dementia, really is an error that's all too common in many medical interactions.
Do you find that medical students right now, do we have to work in educating them about being more compassionate with elderly patients? Has that been an issue or a problem?
It's been a big issue, and it's a reflection of the ageism, Phil, that we have in society. I think you look around, and this is a youth-oriented culture. Young things are worshipped. Older people are sadly expendable, much different than in Eastern cultures where older people are often revered. And increasingly, we find ourselves explaining to folks that unless you're going to be a pediatrician, you're going to be caring for older people. If you're a surgeon, if you're a dermatologist, nearly any field of medicine, a large percentage of your patients are going to be older. And so humanism, the doctor-patient relationship, is really a big feature alongside the complex internal medicine as it relates to older people that we're trying to impart to young medical students.
I want to get back to this, but we're all, as baby boomers and as a society, we're worried about aging, and are there ways to prevent this? But it is time to take a short break. Please don't go anywhere. We'll have more with Dr. Mark Lax, the Irene F. and I. Roy Patsy Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and you are listening to How to Save Your Life. Welcome back. to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Mark Lax. Before the break, I asked a question of Dr. Lax regarding the concept of preventing aging, and he corrected me during the break to indicate that we shouldn't think of aging as a disease process, but rather that, you know, there are individual organs and body parts that start to deteriorate with age. And the question I really wanted to ask and rephrase is, there is a huge push by companies on the radio and on TV to buy drugs, the wonder drugs that are going to prevent the aging process. And I want to make the public aware. What are your thoughts about those drugs? Is there anything that works?
Well, look, I think that in general, Phil, Americans have some of the most expensive urine in the world. Many of the supplements and drugs that are offered are simply, you know, excreted. Having said that, you know, I have many patients who will come to me with 20 or 30 pages of internet printouts, and I tell them that we can sit and read through these, or I can spend this next hour or so examining you and talking about your medical conditions. I will say that I think geriatricians are not as dismissive of alternative and complementary therapies. My general posture is that when patients come to me with a supplement or something that I don't know about, I say, you know, let's learn about this together. Let's read about it. Let's see if there's scientific evidence in the form of a randomized trial or something that meets reasonable scientific criteria to see if something works. More often than not, that evidence does not exist, and the claims are, quite frankly, hype. So, again, it's on a case-by-case basis. I'm all for hope, but I'd much rather have my patients be spending their money on a Tai Chi class or bona fide supplements in the form of a good multivitamin than some of the outlandish supplements that they've often been proffered.
So you mentioned Tai Chi. What types of things can you do? You're not going to prevent aging, but you're going to prevent deterioration. What are the kinds of things that a patient can do for themselves to help their body fight off some of those aches and pains?
Two short words, keep moving. Things that are in motion tend to stay in motion, like that law of physics. Yes, there's compelling evidence for individual types of exercise for individual problems. Tai Chi has been used by some geriatricians and physical therapists to deal specifically with balance difficulties. Falling and immobility is a big problem in older people. But any type of exercise, particularly aerobic exercise in a physician-supervised program, and it's not just the physical activity, Phil. The socialization that occurs with exercise, walking groups, the connectedness that people have you know, when they exercise together, it produces cardiovascular benefit and a general sense of well-being that is simply pervasive. So I think we're learning more and more about exercise each day. There have been recent trials to look at high-intensity weight training for patients after they've fractured a hip, for example, to see if that could prevent further falls. But use it or lose it really is the mantra, I think. And I think that's true whether or not we're talking about the body or we're talking about the mind. I think people who are actively engaged intellectually, you know, I find that my patients who are on the internet, emailing their grandchildren at college, really embracing new technologies to the extent that they want to, have an active engagement with life and culture and society, and have a positive outlook, do very, very well. And I see it reproducibly in patients that I care for.
You bring up an interesting topic. You use the word connectedness. And, you know, personally, our family's going through this. Both of our parents are 89 and 85 years old, and they just moved into an assisted living facility. And then the next step is a nursing home and then a chronic care facility. It's all kind of linked. Are those good? Are they bad? We as a family went through some feelings of guilt in terms of, you know, they're moving into this kind of a scenario. Should they move in with us? What do you have to tell the people?
Well, you know, a few generations ago, there was no need for assisted living or nursing homes, or a need for a lot less of it, because often older adults are cared for or were cared for in the same home as children in multiple generations. I spent a good deal of time in a home living with my grandparents, which probably has something to do with choosing geriatric medicine as a career. I think, like everything else, there are good ones and bad ones. I think we live in a society that is very mobile. Adult children make career choices where they're on the other side of the country for a job opportunity, and it simply becomes impractical. Whereas a generation ago, several adult children might have been in the same community to provide care and pitch in for an older parent. Now they're just geographically far flung. So I've had many patients who've thrived and done very well in assisted living facilities and in nursing homes. Again, everyone would prefer to be independent. That's every geriatrician's wish for a patient. But it simply becomes impractical for some patients and for some families.
I think that, yeah, that's the one point I wanted to try to bring out is when we looked at institutions, we looked for facilities that forced individuals to have communication, forced individuals to interact and had common dinners together, provided activities. What should we, as children, be looking for when our parents age and it isn't practical to have them move into our home? What questions should they be asking a facility?
Well, again, to the extent that you can go visit these facilities and really take a tour, I ask questions like, how long has the typical staff member been here? What is the staff turnover in a facility like this? Surveys of nursing homes are now available online as performed by the federal government, and one can see the survey records of facilities. Speak to other families in the facility, particularly families who've had a loved one in that facility for a long period of time. And if you do a due diligence process, I think you'll get a sense of what the facility is like. I can't emphasize enough the importance, though, of social connections, the notion of maintaining friendships and ties well after someone lives in a facility that is not their own home.
I want the listeners to be aware that this is a great pleasure and an honor for me to be interviewing Dr. Lax. He is a distinguished individual. Currently, he is the professor of medicine at Cornell and the director of the Cornell Center for Aging and Research and Clinical Care. He has won a number of selected honors, including the National Institutes on Aging Academic Award, the American College of Physicians Teaching and Research Scholarship, American Geriatric Society of New Investigator Award, the American Federation for Aging Research, Beeson Physician Faculty Scholar, National Institutes on Aging and Academic Leadership Award, in addition to having an endowed professorship granted to him by Cornell University. These are all incredible honors that you've achieved at a relatively young age, Dr. Lax. But you mentioned a little bit earlier about living with your grandparents. I mean, what got you into dealing with patients that are 2 to 3 times your age?
Well, I think at first it probably was my grandfather, who was this attorney, robust, former Golden Glove featherweight boxer, actually. I still have his gold pocket watch from the New York Athletic Club. It says featherweight champion, 1919. And, he really was, at an early age, a father figure for me, just an agile intellect, and defied the stereotypes that we see in society of older people as feeble and frail and incapable. He was such a forceful, articulate, physically vibrant man. And, we're faced with these stereotypes of older people in society as doddering and incapable, when in my practice I could introduce you to people who could whip you at bridge, finish a New York Times crossword puzzle in 20 minutes. And so when I got to medical school, I was just intrigued by the idea of marrying that love for older people and the knowledge and the wisdom they possess with some really fascinating medicine. Because, Phil, I'll tell you, no one comes to me with just one problem. I see someone with a sore throat and I get bored, By the time someone gets to me, they may have 2 or 3 concurrent problems: hypertension and emphysema, cardiac disease and vascular disease, depression and gastrointestinal problems. And so the notion of managing multiple diseases simultaneously, making sure a drug prescribed for one thing doesn't cause difficulty in another area, And then layered on top of that, the fascinating social and life histories of these people who really, at the end of the day, are responsible for making this great country we live in. It's such a compelling honor to care for people like that who really deserve better care than they've gotten in a society that just views older people as not worthy.
The thing that I find striking is I lived with my grandmother during 1 year of medical school. She was 89 years old. And the thing that struck me, and also thinking back upon the movie Cocoon, is how hard elderly patients fight not getting old. And, you know, how little we do for them to fight that battle. You know, how can we change that?
Well, again, it's to put yourself in the position of an older person. And the fascinating thing about ageism, this sort of racism that's really different from other forms of prejudice in our society, and it's really quite an irony, Phil, if you think about it. It's the only form of prejudice that if you're lucky enough to survive and get older, you become the object of your own discrimination. You know, it's really quite interesting. And for that reason, whenever I'm, for example, taking medical students through our nursing home, I always make it a point to take them to see the physician patients who live in our nursing home. And that's really such an eye-opening experience for them, because they realize that that this older person who may appear physically frail and in need of assistance, who may or may not be intellectually vital, was once them, you know. And that really is a transforming experience, I find.
How common is depression in the elderly population? You mentioned it a little bit earlier as one of the disease processes that you have to deal with. So is it real common? And number two, in an elderly patient, is it more difficult to combat?
Well, it's common. It's common in the general population, and it's common in older people. Estimates range anywhere from 10 to 30% in various populations, even higher in patients, for example, newly admitted to assisted living facilities and nursing homes. The difficulty in treating it, and this is quite fascinating, I find, Phil, is stigma. Often for this cohort of older person, the notion of taking antidepressants or seeking out psychotherapy is viewed as a lack of moral fiber. You and I grew up in a therapy-prone age and in a therapy-prone culture. But frequently, the biggest battle in treating depression in older people is not finding the right medication, but getting them to agree to medication in the first place. I'll tell you that it's one of the most gratifying experiences in all of geriatric medicine to lift an older person from a profound depression with the appropriate use of psychotherapy referral and the use of medications. Those medications have become much safer in the last decade or two. In the 70s and 80s, we had medicines that had lots of toxicity for older people, heart toxicity. And so older people often are unwilling or resistant to taking medication. And I explained to them that, look, this is a brain chemistry problem. You wouldn't be angry at your pancreas if it stopped producing insulin, right? This is a brain chemistry issue. The other problem in the treatment of depression, and this is where education comes in with respect to physicians, is physician recognition. Geriatric depression can have a different face than the depression we see in younger people. So, for example, in geriatrics, we frequently talk about depression without sadness. We're taught in the care of younger adults that people are often tearful or have low energy. And that can happen in older people, but often older people will develop, for example, complaints of pain with no ostensible sadness or change in mood. And it can be very, very challenging to figure out. Some patients will develop intellectual impairment and memory loss that can look very much like Alzheimer's disease or dementia. And more than one older adult has been misdiagnosed with Alzheimer's disease who actually had a depression, a reversible, treatable cognitive problem. And in fact, the geriatric psychiatrists have a name for that. They call it pseudo-dementia, reflecting the fact that the person doesn't really have a dementia, but a depression which is masquerading as a dementia.
You know, it's one of the common things around hospitals is you're not necessarily paranoid when, in fact, people actually are trying to take your job or do something harmful to you. In the same regard to being depressed, I mean, you know, I'm 89 years old. My joints don't work. My eyes don't work as well. I can't see. I can't hear that well. And I'm now, all of a sudden, I can't drive. Is it a different kind of depression? Is it better treated with medication, or is it better treated with psychotherapy?
Well, bravo. I think you're right. And add to that the social losses, the bereavement, the loss of friends, in addition to the loss of physical functioning. And I've had more than one patient who said to me, you know, Mark, you know, damn it, I have a right to be miserable. I've had these losses in my life, and just let me be. But I think when mood disturbance is prolonged, if it affects functioning, if people, for example, stop eating, the medications have become relatively safe. It's often worthy of a trial of antidepressants to see if people can improve their functioning. And again, to dismiss mood complaints or low energy states, which might be depression, as old age, just getting old. And again, geriatricians have this favorite joke that we like to tell. I think it's attributed to a very famous geriatrician named Bob Butler, who was the first director of the National Institutes on Aging. A man goes into his doctor and he says, "Doctor, my right knee hurts." Doctor says, "How old are you?" And the man says, I'm 85. And the doctor has an ageist response. He says, "What do you expect at your age?" That's him attributing that man's symptom to old age. And the man gets up defiantly and he says, "You know, Doc, the problem with that explanation is my left knee is 85 and it doesn't hurt at all." Now, jokes are meant to convey a truth. And in this case, this is a fellow who didn't get his pain properly worked up because it was attributed to old age. And again, I tell patients that aging is not a disease. There are diseases that are more common, like arthritis, which might be responsible for this man's knee pain as we age. But if you don't investigate those causes, and we have great treatments for arthritis now, medications, injections, physical therapy, then you'll never get to the bottom of it. And look, I mean, sometimes patients come to me with various pain complaints, Phil, and I work it up and I'm assiduous, and I don't get to the bottom of what's causing their discomfort. But at the end of the day, they know that I've left no stone unturned, and they feel like their complaints have been taken seriously and they've been heard. And even when that's the case, we haven't talked about palliative care, which is not just for people who are at the end of life. There are treatments for individuals with pain and discomfort, and those should be, you know, very, very aggressively pursued because it's a quality of life and functional issue. And I always come back to function when I talk about aging with you.
One question when we come back is to just help give some of the younger people in the audience maybe five signs for what depression looks like in their family members and how they can then at least steer that family member towards medical help. We'll be right back with Dr. Mark Lax after this short break. You're listening to How to Save Your Life. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Mark Lax, the Irene F. and I. Roy Passati Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University and the Director of the Cornell Center for Aging and Research and Clinical Care. Before we left for the break, Mark, we were talking a little bit about depression, and I wanted you to help the listeners and list some signs and or symptoms that they might look for in their loved ones for depression.
Well, sure, Phil. Again, if patients are overtly sad or tearful, the kind of depression we see in younger people, then that would be a telltale sign. But as I said earlier, older patients often won't manifest sadness. So they might, for example, have multiple complaints of pain in different body areas. Now, of course, that needs to be worked up by a physician, but if those persist in the absence of a unifying or good diagnosis, that might be a telltale sign that it's depression. Memory loss or difficulty concentrating is a cardinal sign of depression. And again, as I said earlier, often that's misdiagnosed as an early dementia like Alzheimer's disease. Some patients will simply present with tiredness or low energy, and after their family doctor excludes an anemia or another problem, one should really be thinking about a depression. And then often we see in older patients a general irritability without sadness. And in a smaller number of patients, we sometimes see odd thoughts, delusions. Those are seen frequently in Alzheimer's disease, but there are patients with geriatric forms of depression who will present with paranoia or odd ideas or odd behaviors. And obviously those individuals should be thoroughly evaluated for a depressive or other disorder.
This leads us into another category of disease processes that you see in an elderly patient, and I'm referring to the failure to thrive, which can be something that you see in an elderly patient that is depressed. What are the reasons for an elderly individual to fail to thrive, and then are there ways that we as family members can help prevent that?
Well, again, I hate the diagnosis. It's an ICD-9 that stands for International Classification of Diseases diagnosis, the formal book we use to write down diagnoses with a number. And I think it was sort of haphazardly taken from pediatrics, where we use the term failure to thrive for children who are not gaining weight at appropriate age and age milestones, weight and height. Again, the problem with terms like failure to thrive is it promotes kind of an intellectual laziness among physicians, because you'll say, oh, it's failure to thrive, patient is declining. But in fact, the physician should be aggressively looking for things like depression, as we've described, perhaps an early dementia. I've had more than one patient losing weight who's had a very expensive, fancy workup, when in fact, it was a series of dental problems or ill-fitting dentures that was responsible for their decline. And a lot of money could have been saved with a trip to the dentist, had a smart physician taking a look in the person's mouth. And yes, there are a series of odd and rare diseases, occult malignancies, undetected cancers that can produce this. But more often than not, my experience is that it's not that. Drugs and drug interactions is something that we frequently think about. You know, we live in a subspecialized society. It's particularly bad in New York, where you have one guy cares for your right thumb, another guy for your left thumb, and each of those guys may prescribe a medicine. At best, that is inconvenient, and at worst, it can be life-threatening. And most geriatricians will ask patients to bring the entire brown bag of their medications to the office, and you know, Phil, I've seen collections of medications from many patients acquired over a decade that would rival those the entire pharmacy stock of third world countries. It's really quite compelling. And you'll find that patients are taking medicines that interact, over-the-counter medications, supplements. And part of a geriatric evaluation is really looking at medications very carefully. And in fact, even when I have patients who are doing very, very well, I look at a big list of medications and I say to myself, which of these might I be able to eliminate? Because the body changes the way it metabolizes medications as we age, and drugs that would have been cleared in a few hours might last for a day or two or three.
Yeah, as I sit here listening to you, I'm going, you know, I'm out there listening to this on the radio. there's only 7,000 of you out there, which means to me that there probably are very few in North and South Dakota. Is there a way for somebody to find a geriatric specialist? Is there a web page where people can go to find out how to get access to you all?
It's a great question, and I frequently get calls, and probably will after a radio show like this, about finding a geriatrician in a community. One place you might go is the website of the American Geriatric Society. They're located in New York, and they might provide assistance in finding a geriatrician in your local community. A very good place to start is your local medical school, because invariably, while smaller communities may not have geriatricians or have one or two, most medical schools in the United States in the year 2006 have academic geriatric programs and a geriatric practice that's based there, or they will know how to get to one in your local community. So those are two very good places to start.
Great. Every time we open up the metropolitan section of the newspaper or one of our dailies, we read about some other horrific story about elderly abuse or elder abuse and neglect. Is it as common as you would suspect it is in reading these newspapers? And if it is, what should we, who don't believe in it, look for in our neighbor's house?
Well, you know, this is a research area of expertise of mine, and I've devoted a good deal of my professional career to combating elder abuse and neglect and protecting the rights and dignity of older people. I wish I could tell you, Phil, that it's uncommon, but in fact, it's shockingly common. There have been a number of prevalence studies in the United States, and it would suggest that prevalence of elder abuse is somewhere in the 4 or 5% range. That means that, you know, one out of every 20-ish person that you see in a practice is a victim of elder abuse or neglect. It takes a variety of different forms. Sometimes it's an outright physical assault of behavior, but it also is neglect, withholding medicines, food, or care. And an exploding area of elder abuse is financial exploitation of older people. You know, getting the house or the car or the bank account or the Social Security check for drugs or for other things rather than the benefit of the older person. We're sort of where child abuse was in the early 1960s with elder abuse. You know, until some very important studies came out in that era, people didn't believe that child abuse actually existed. And we know now that this is out there. It's more common than we would like to believe. And what's interesting is that it's frequently misdiagnosed. Why is it misdiagnosed? Because we live in an ageist society. You know, Phil, a child dies of child abuse. That's big news. Children are not supposed to die. But I can't tell you how frequently I've seen cases where an older person, there was a strong suspicion where a person lived in an abusive environment. They may have died of malnutrition from not being fed or from other injuries or lack of care. And the instinct of a coroner or an investigating police officer is always, well, it must be their emphysema or their cardiac disease. And so you're seeing ageism really in that venue as well. I teach physicians that since older people in abuse situations often become isolated, and that's true of all forms of family violence where it comes to involve only the abuser and the victim, that it may be that one primary care visit a year where you see the older person that represents the only opportunity to intervene and make an appropriate referral to Adult Protective Services, which in most states is the equivalent of child services for an older person. Again, you know, if a child is beaten and appears in school with a black eye or doesn't appear in school, there's some modern-day equivalent of a truant officer who makes an appropriate referral. But because older people often are not in the workforce and may be in an isolated situation with an abuser, it can go unnoticed. And so the public and physicians and everyone who comes in contact with older people need to have an antenna up that elder abuse is out there and it's real.
Well, I mean, it comes to mind because just recently, over the past couple of weeks, there's been a rather prominent socialite in the New York arena that there have been some accusations that that may have been going on. So if it can happen to an individual like that, obviously it could happen to anybody. You know, here's an individual that had unlimited means to prevent that. So what do we do? I mean, certainly if it's not true, you don't want to hurt the family for asking the question, but if it is true, you want to help the person who's being abused or neglected. What kind of steps can we take?
Well, again, if you look at the way the pediatricians have handled child abuse, I think it's one of the most magnificent examples of physician advocacy for a social problem, really, in the history of medicine. I mean, you see child abuse in pediatric textbooks alongside diseases like cardiac defects and rickets. You know, it's part of the curriculum, and I think we need to make it part of the curriculum of geriatric medicine and general medicine, since I've already told you that most of the primary care is provided by general physicians who care for older people. I think we need to remove some of the stigma for reporting. To get a license in this state, I had to get a child abuse training certificate. I'd like to see a day when physicians who care for older people have such a requirement. And in every community, there are resources that can discreetly investigate potential complaints of elder abuse and neglect. And in fact, in most states, in about 46 states, elder abuse reporting is mandatory for certain individuals. So even the suspicion of elder abuse, say by a physician, is supposed to result in a call to Adult Protective Services. If you look in your yellow pages or your white pages, there's an organization called an Area Agency on Aging in every community, in every jurisdiction, or AAA. And those individuals invariably have access to an elder abuse hotline or can put you in touch with people who can properly adjudicate what might be a case of elder abuse, but might be a case of an individual who is failing for legitimate reasons. Again, I teach the medical students that, you know, as a rule, you know, kids don't break their hips. So when an older person comes to the emergency room with a hip fracture, yes, it could be osteoporosis, but it could also be that someone was pushed or injured in an elder abuse situation. So it's having a reasonable index of suspicion and not keeping our head in the sand that this is not a real problem and doesn't exist. No one would do that to dear old grandma or grandpa because it's out there.
One of the things you said earlier about how to slow down the aging process is, you know, use it or lose it. And, you know, short of the common issues, I've got a bad heart, so I can't get out and get around, or I've got bad lungs, which would be dealt with by specialists, cardiologists, and pulmonary doctors. I think one of the more common things you see is the patient with the walker. They've got leg problems. They can't walk. They've got hearing aids in both ears. And, you know, they've got thick glasses because they can't see. And they feel self-conscious about that. What are the practical things? What can a person who's in their 50s, they're still not old, you know, and they want to maintain their mobility so they can use their intellectual capacity. What are the substantive kind of things that a person can do? You know, should they run marathons or should they do low-impact aerobics, stretching exercises? Give us some insight.
Well, again, one of the questions I'm frequently asked is, you know, how much of this is genetics and how much of this is lifestyle choice? And yeah, there are families that have longevity genes. We know now there are families, if you're lucky enough to get one of those genes, you can live a long time. But I tell patients and the adult children of my patients in their 30s, 40s, and 50s that lifestyle choices during that age range really are very significant predictors of what you'll be like as an older person. So, for example, with regard to hearing, I think we're going to see a rash of hearing loss from iPods and portable devices, and the ear, nose, and throat doctors call that acoustic trauma, and it's real. And I suspect that the audiologists are going to be very busy and very much in demand. So, again, sensible precautions sort of in that area.
I think. Let me just interrupt you. I mean, one of the things I notice in interviewing people is so much of this, of our disease processes, are self-inflicted. I mean, how do we convince our kids, you know, turn that iPod down? Because you know it's going to be a setup for problems when they're 80.
Well, you know, by introducing them to some older people who have lost their hearing, and maybe Pete Townsend from The Who, I'm told, is quite a good deal of hearing loss. And it just stands to reason if people are exposed over young adult life, that's what's going to happen. But yes, I'm fighting that same battle at home myself.
Back to the questions about prevention. Orthopedic problems are real common. Back pain, leg pain, hip problems. What can they do to slow that process down?
Well, again, the jury's still out on what running over the course of a lifetime, you know, does to your knees or to your back. I generally endorse for my younger, older patients at least 3 times a week of aerobic activity that's not high impact. I think swimming is a terrific activity. I like walking because it can be a social activity as well.
Yoga, Tai Chi.
Yoga and Tai Chi are terrific. They are somewhat aerobic. They're not as aerobic as the cardiovascular benefits from walking, from ambulation. But again, you know, reasonably strenuous physical activity under the supervision of a physician 3 or 4 times a week for 20 to 30 minutes, and then more if you are so inclined, not pushing yourself to the point of exhaustion or fatigue, and listening to your body, not going out and trying to do it all at once after you've been a couch potato for 6 months or a year. But again, I always come back to the use it or lose it paradigm.
We're closing down on the hour. If there's a message that you wanted to leave for the elderly patient, what would you say?
Well, you know, I think it was John Kennedy who had a great quote. He said, you know, it's not about adding years to life. It's about adding life to years. You know, I am not interested in keeping people alive till 110 if they're bedbound nursing home residents. That's not my goal. I'm interested in keeping people old and functionally independent. The goal is to leave this earth active, bungee jumping, rollerblading, playing bridge, whatever it is you do that you enjoy doing. And again, it's through this modern miracle of medicine, people like you, Phil, that we're seeing lots and lots of older people. The emphasis is on function and independence and not necessarily a chronologic number.
Again, it has been my distinct pleasure and honor to have Dr. Mark Lax, the Irene F. and I. Roy Psatty Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University and Director of the Cornell Center for Aging Research and Clinical Care. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
Thank you.